Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where sales leaders teach you what's working for them and how you can build it yourself.
This episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast is brought to you by our sales coaching and consulting services. Are you looking to create repeatable, scalable, and predictable revenue? We've helped thousands of companies grow their business with tailored expert advice backed by testing to ensure they establish the best practices that'll work for them. Head over to bit.ly/predictable revenue coaching to learn more.
If you're not telling a compelling story, then you're losing your audience before you've even started. Numbers make people believe, but stories make them engaged listeners. I'm your host, Sarah Hicks, and today on the Predictable Revenue Podcast, I'm going to be chatting to an expert about how to create the perfect pitch deck. She's a corporate storyteller, has worked globally for over 16 years with Fortune 500 companies, startups, and investors in a wide variety of industries. She's consulted and trained clients in over 30 countries, and through her guidance, clients have raised over $1 billion. She has the ability to magically spin raw data into compelling stories that captivate audiences and drive results, which is exactly why I've asked her on the show to teach us the same thing. Donna Griffith, welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Sarah. Great to be here.
So why, in the context of creating a pitch deck, is storytelling so important?
So I think the answer is in the question. The deck is a story. And I think that there's a big misnomer about storytelling. People think it's like a buzz, telling a little icebreaker, making some jokes, telling some stories, where there's actually a few different elements, but the entire pitch deck is a story. And when we say story, we're talking about like thousands of year old artifacts of literature, of the greats, and the way that information was conveyed when we first had language, you know, coming out of the cave days. And that's how our brains formed. And that's how communication was formed. And it's the oldest form of communication, and it's still the most powerful form of communication. So a pitch deck should be a story, not just a row of numbers and facts and figures.
So what do you see people getting wrong the most with pitch decks right now?
Where do I begin? It's not just now. It's something that it boggles my mind time and time again. And I've been doing this for nearly two decades, and I still get shocked how people haven't learned. Things being disjointed and out of order, jumping around, making it very numbers oriented, no story element to it, nothing, you know, that relates the customer experience. Overloading with information, Overloading with bullets and numbers. And it's just to the point where the listener simply cannot absorb.
Yeah. And do you think that's because maybe with kind of products becoming more and more, you know, common, obviously like the software product is only something that's a bit over a decade old, except for some of the big ones that are a tiny bit older than that. But is it something that has gotten worse because of kind of all of the data in the product? Or have you seen that even, you know, with services companies before that, they want to focus on data more than anything else?
I worked with hardware companies before that, and, you know, early software. And it's always been the case. I think it kind of comes from this fear of them not getting it and us not looking like we understand it. So what we do to compensate is just throw everything on the slide, every little bit of data we can get, just pop it on there. I remember walking into companies like Intel when I would train there and just see these, they'd call them foils, because in once upon a time, they were actually written on foils. That just, I'm dating myself now, but, and it just like, there would be masses upon masses of bullet points in like an 8-point font. And my eyes would just start bleeding before I even heard the person speaking. And then you'd have all these like architectures and high level bits and bytes. And it was exhausting. So I've seen this happening forever. I think things have actually improved, but there's still this sense of like, I need to tell them everything. I need to throw everything at them and then something will stick, which is the absolute opposite of what they should be doing.
Yeah, I think it definitely comes down to people think that the data makes them credible, when if you are just telling a mass of irrelevant data, it doesn't actually make you any more credible than if you were telling something like distilled, clear, part of, as you said, this kind of story arc that expresses information the way our brains are designed to receive and retain it. Well, okay, perfect. Let's walk people through your structure or your framework then of how to design an impactful, powerful, effective pitch deck.
Happy to, just to piggyback on what you said, because you nailed it at that point. It's like this, it's the antithesis of what they should be doing. You should be giving a distilled, clear, concise view, because you come across looking much smarter that way. And then let them ask you questions. Don't feel the need to throw everything at them, because it's like drinking from a fire hydrant and nobody enjoys that as far as I know. So what to do instead? So if we're talking stories and we're talking greats, my mind always goes to Shakespeare and Chekhov and Moliere and the greats that were our you know, the even go back to Greek tragedies, even the Bible. If you look at the Bible as a literature, as even if it's not a religious connotation, it's the way things are structured in chunks, in acts, in chapters. And that, again, is like the basic way of the base of our communication. So if you think of an investor deck or a sales deck as a four-act play, then, and we go back to the archetypal, and again, we're looking at things that have been in movie scripts again and again. So there's this structure there. So first we see the problem, the villain that emerges. Someone is threatening the lives of Gotham. And so that's the exposition. That's where we meet the problem. Now, people might be thinking, oh, that's so simplistic, problem, solution. We've heard that. And yeah, it is simplistic. And again, it's been around for thousands of years. This is nothing that I've invented. It's just taking it and adapting it to startups in a way that's easy for them to execute. So the problem, and the best way to tell it is with a story. So you can weave the storytelling into the storytelling framework. Talk about your origin story. Where did you come up with the idea? What was the pain you identified in your lives or in the lives of someone that you cared about? I have a client who started his journey in creating a platform for diabetes management and a supplement that actually helps people lower their insulin, because his father was diagnosed midlife with diabetes, and he saw this strong man who loved to eat and loved to celebrate life having all these limitations. And he said, I vow to find a cure or an alleviation for this. And it set him on a journey, and he's created an incredible company that's now acquiring other companies and really building something meaningful for chronic illnesses all over. So where did you start the journey? What inspired you, and what is the problem? And then you can expand it from your micro to the macro. So start with like what you saw, and then, but there's a much bigger problem in the market. So many more people, and then throw in numbers. 67% of people suffering from chronic illness find that, you know, blah, blah, blah. So show that it's a pretty big problem. And then act two, out comes the hero. The hero emerges, your product, your solution. Be able to explain that to us simply. Simple solution statement. We do X for Y by Z. As simple as that anyone could get, anyone could understand without all the buzzwords and everything around it. Peel that away. What is it that you're really doing? And you can then show us a demo. Take us on the user journey. Let us see, showcase your product through a user story. It's much more powerful that way. It can be a video. It can be screenshots. Use a real client if you can, because it's much more powerful. Even if you have to anonymize them, you're telling a true story of someone who adores you. And that's also getting points with investors, because they'll probably want to talk to your clients anyway. Yeah. Act three, the business. So the hero's plan. What is the hero going to do to succeed? So the numbers, the fact, the figures, the business model, the market, the go-to-market, the competitive landscape, that goes in there. And that's usually the bucket that people start off with, and they start throwing all this. Now, granted, you do want to show them there's a big market from the beginning, but you don't have to get so deep into it at the very beginning. And finally, the fourth act, which oftentimes people don't give enough power to. It's the where do we go from here? Now that the hero has succeeded, what will the future look like? Where are you going? What's your big vision? What will the company have shifted in the market when you are successful 3, 5, 8 years from now? What are the milestones that'll get you there? Additional markets. And then, of course, What do you need in order to make this vision happen? What's your ask? And that's the four-act play: problem, solution, business, and moving forward.
Wow. Yeah, very simple. For people that are maybe technically inclined, like these sort of technical founders that are now tasked with this, creating a story out of potentially like a bunch of user data from a product, and these people that maybe don't have the natural inclination for being able to create a story, how would you recommend being able to look at that data and extract the story from it?
Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer for doing it yourself. I mean, right. I can help with the framework that I've given you. That's why people work with me. So it's very hard when it's your own and you're like stuck in the weeds to see what other people are seeing from the outside. So you have to literally zoom out and take a 30,000 feet look at it and look at it from the perspective of someone who's never seen it or heard about it before. The AI, ML, deep learning, all these other things, you know, these buzzwords aren't necessarily going to be what's impressing them. Go for what does it mean? What does it truly mean? They'll get into how it works and the nitty gritty and the tech when they do due diligence on you and send experts. But they really want to understand the impact this is making, problem and solving, and why is it so different from everything else out there that people will be willing to throw money at you so you can make their lives better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I think sometimes it's so difficult to kind of zoom out and have that clear perspective. So it makes sense that that's when, if you don't have, say, like a, yeah, exactly. If you don't have like a non-technical co-founder that you can lean on, that's when you should pull in an expert like yourself, somebody that can.
Right. But I see it happening even with non-technical co-founders because they're right. So entrenched in the story and invested in the story and they've forgotten, you know, what they don't know. So they're so into it. It's like, how do people not understand this? I'm living this day after day. And it's totally understandable. So we just have to take a step back, put ourselves in the position of someone listening for the first time.
Okay. Makes sense. But then you did mention that there is, of course, some data that's useful to include in there because you've got a little tidbits, kind of little bits of credibility to back up this story. What types of data do you think are the right types of data to leave in this story?
So you definitely want to do some kind of an under the hood or you know, your technology so that they understand on a high level that you do have technology and kind of how it works. They can always ask more, but you want to sketch it out in a very simplistic way so that they do understand that there is deep technology here. If you have IP, you have patents pending, definitely let them know that because that gives you an advantage. That gives you a true edge. Numbers, growth, metrics of engagement, of revenue. And that's where numbers, and you want to get the big chunky numbers. That's where it's really impressive. And you don't want to get vanity metrics. You want to get something that's truly measurable. And I also suggest if you have strong numbers, 20, 30, 40% month over month growth, 30K MRR, huge, massive engagement rates with thousands of monthly active users. Those are the kind of things you want to put up front. I call it the brag slide. So especially if you're raising a Series A and beyond, you don't want to wait to deliver good news. You want to find like the six most wow numbers of your sales, of your pipeline, of your engagement, of your growth, of your customer acquisition, so that they see from the beginning, oh, well, this is a company that's serious. They've really done some work and they've achieved things.
Yeah, that makes sense. So picking out both the most impressive, but then the most kind of measurable, true, as you said, not vanity metrics. I think definitely people see through the vanity metric now. Like we're well aware now of what really is a marker of kind of success in a growing company versus, yeah, these vanity metrics, as you say, like, I don't know, number of leads, like clicks, all that kind of stuff. I think we're moving beyond. Okay.
Paid clicks. Nobody's going to get too excited about that. Anyone can. You want to show organic growth. You want to show word of mouth. You want to show virality. You want to show testimonials, people that love you, that are, you know, just can't imagine their lives without you, stickiness. Those are important things.
Yeah.
So go quantitative and qualitative.
Yeah. Makes sense. I have a question around competition. If you're coming out into a space that is, whether it just has one competitor or even it's a little, you know, crowded, that space, how do you weave in that piece of it? Kind of not just your differentiator in general, but like, okay, we know that there's this competitor. How do you kind of name that and move beyond that in your pitch deck?
Look, they're likely going to know your competitors anyway. So the more forthcoming you are, the more you show that you know your market. You can't hide behind it because it's there. So I say, you know, sit on the elephant in the room and just go for a little ride. Don't try to ignore it. So you want to show that you're very familiar with your competitive landscape and you understand what your true differentiation is. And you want to display it visually, which is really important. On my website under resources, I show some examples of the best way to visually explain it. But when you have X's and checks and Harvey balls and all those things that people have to work, if they're working too hard to understand how you're showing your competitive landscape, they're not listening to you. They're just reading what's on the slide. And that goes for a lot of verbiage as well. So show it visually. And then you want to talk about your true differentiation. You never want to speak ill of your competitors. It's great that you have competitors. It means that you have a market. And you want to leverage their success and their heat to show that this is something that's truly in demand and you have something truly unique, better, different than what they do. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there is an ideal length for a pitch deck in terms of like number of slides, or does it vary depending on the content?
So I have a bone to pick with Guy Kawasaki about the 10 slide thing, because what that has done, like when saying, you know, if you can't explain your company in 10 slides, what people do, again, we talked about this at the beginning, they will shove everything into these 10 slides and they'll end up looking like an eye chart at the DMV. You don't want to do that. So for me, my rule of thumb is one big idea per slide. I'd rather you have more slides with less on them than fewer slides that are jam-packed with bullets. Mm-hmm. So nobody's sitting there counting your slides as much as they're listening to you. And if you're keeping succinct and to the point, that's great. You can pick out, you know, maybe 8-10 slides for a send out deck that are clean, crisp. You can add some text to them. But when you're delivering it. So, I mean, just to give you kind of an average size for a typical investor pitch, we end up with anywhere from like 15 to 25 slides, depending. Sometimes they'll show a demo and it'll spread out on a few different slides. Sometimes they have more testimonials, more traction. Whereas like a 5-minute slide for a competition, somewhere between 10 and 15 slides as well. Again, it's just about telling the story. How many slides do you need to tell the story in a neat and compelling way?
Right. So don't be kind of constrained by some imposed number of slides. Rather, tell your story as clearly and effectively and powerfully as possible and forget about the number.
Stick to the framework. I mean, I'm sitting in front of a window now. I see 4 different houses in front of me. They all look different, but they all have one thing in common. They have a frame and a foundation. I don't see the frame or foundation, but I know it's there because otherwise the house would be crumbled to the ground. So you can put the facade, the walls, the shingles, the garden, and make it your own, but stick to the framework of the messaging, of the problem solution business moving forward, because that'll hold it and that'll hold them, and then show us your best.
Yeah. And there's almost like an anxiety that it would produce in your listener, like in the investor that you're pitching to, when it does move all over the place. And you're, as you mentioned, you see people that are kind of like, there's bits and pieces in random orders and all that kind of stuff. I know for myself, when like watching somebody do something that feels discombobulated and kind of out of order, my attention goes to that. Like I'm not consuming the actual information that's being shared so much as being like that. I don't understand. Wait, take me back. Like you're definitely putting yourself at a massive disadvantage if you don't, as you mentioned, have like an underlying solid framework, even if it feels rigid or it feels simplistic, like some people have said, it's so much better to be that. And then you add these little flourishes than it to be just like a pile of rubble.
I think about, you know, cities that have an L train, that have a train that runs on tracks that are almost invisible. And, you know, trying to go off the tracks is not very smart because you're derailed. You're like, oh, well, let me try it another way. No, I mean, stick to the tracks and then just you make the journey your own. Mm-hmm. Stay with the through line. It's invisible. It's seamless. It's not they're going to see, oh, you're doing the problem solution thing. No, they're just getting it in an orderly fashion that their poor, overworked, overloaded brains can absorb.
Yeah. What do you think about kind of scripting your own part? Do you think that that is an important thing to do? Or yeah,
absolutely. I think it's important. I don't say memorize it. I do say script. Like I literally, when I work with clients, I script out exactly what I would like to hear them say on a given slide in their speaker's notes. And then I tell them, make it your own. So instead of memorizing verbatim, that's where you're going to trip up because you forget one word and then you're totally blacked out. So instead, familiarize yourself with what you're going to say on the slide, practice it again and again, go on a walk, have on your phone in Google Slides with speaker's notes open, and then just walk it and talk it to yourself. And then, oh, forgot something. Took a peek. It's there. And get yourself as familiar enough with it as if I could wake you up in the middle of the night, you'd be able to pitch me without hesitating. That's where I want it. Yeah. I want it to be a part of you. I always tell people it's your words, but elevated. I'm there to help synthesize it and put it all together, but it's your words. I'm not saying how I would say it. I'm listening mm-hmm. to you and putting the ideas together.
Right. Got to be like second nature so that regardless of what's thrown at you in that context, you can continue on. You can express those ideas without kind of faltering.
Exactly.
And then you mentioned the kind of send out and how you can do a kind of condensed version of the pitch deck. So what do you think is a good kind of rule of thumb there? Should you send something for people to look at ahead of time, after, what should it contain, all of that?
So they're definitely going to want to see something before. And you know, some European, UK, Middle Eastern countries still work with the one pager, which is kind of a snapshot on a front and a back to it of what you've written in your deck. It could be one page or two. But here, and especially in Silicon Valley, nobody wants to bother reading a one pager. So they'll, you know, send a teaser deck. Some people will ask for the full deck. So mm-hmm. have both versions ready. So what I say with the teaser deck or the send out deck is choose your, you know, 8-10 most compelling slides that are, save some surprises for the meeting itself, but enough that makes them see you have been successful. You've got a clear mission, vision, solution to a problem that's got a true need, any traction that you have, that there's a big market, enough that they say, this is interesting enough that I want to meet this person.
Mm-hmm. And then is that kind of enough? That's what you leave them with after? Is there something else that you should follow up with post?
So you can send your full deck after the meeting if they ask for it. Always wait, like, first of all, after a meeting, you know, the same day or the next day, send a thank you. It was great meeting with you. I particularly enjoy hearing you say or learning this, like really mention something that you appreciated from the meeting, because that shows that you were really taking in their feedback. If you've promised to send them anything, any information, any data, go ahead and send that. And then follow up again, maybe 4 days later or 4 days to a week if you haven't heard from them. I always do like 4 follow-ups before I just throw in the towel and say, you know, this is gone. So it's not that doesn't mean that that's a no. It just means it's a no for now. Nobody wants to say the no. Nobody wants a hard no, because then just move them to your update list. So your quarterly update list to investors, and just, you're going to tell them about all the great traction you've made. And don't be surprised if 6 months from now, suddenly you hear from this person, hey, how are you? It's been ages. We should talk. And don't be like, oh, now you want to talk? Now you want to talk? Now that I'm a big success? Now. No, don't do that. Play the game. Be smart. Because if they don't say a hard no, or they leave a door open, there's always a chance for a yes in the future.
Yeah,
and it
true.
Gives you the opportunity to see who are the people that you truly want to work with. You're auditioning them as much as they're auditioning you. This is a role that's going to last longer than marriages.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, amazing. We've kind of walked through the entire process, the preparation, building, of course, the perfect pitch deck that encompasses that four act play structure. One more time, repeat for us the four acts, the what to put in there.
The problem, the villain, the need, or by the way, it can also be the gap, the opportunity, the carrot, the, ooh, we have a chance. I mean, it's not like somebody thought, oh my gosh, what's missing from my life is watching people dance to silly music and do routines. But you know, here we go, TikTok. So it's more like the boredom or the missing a great opportunity. That's, so that also can be the first act. Second act, your solution, how it works, how the user uses it, bring it to life for us. Third act, the business, the market, the revenue model, go-to-market, competition. And finally, where do we go from here? The vision for the future and what you need to fuel that vision.
Amazing. And we've talked about what to keep in there, what to leave out, how not to be bound by kind of artificial constraints and just make sure that it's powerful and concise and clear in one big idea per slide. We've talked about what to give your investors before, after, during as their kind of visual aid for the whole thing. Perfect. So interesting. I mean, I'm prepared now if I'm ever going to pitch. And honestly, while we were talking about this, I have a friend who is currently going through that, this whole process of getting ready to start to pitch investors. And so I'm asking from that selfish perspective, like, how can I prepare him for the, for all those pitches that he's in Silicon Valley right now, getting ready to do it. So
great. Well, he's welcome to check out the resources on my site, donnagriffith.com. There's a cheat sheet for the investor deck, for the competition slide. I go into a lot of detail there. So it's there for the taking. So
nice. Well, we'll certainly include the link to that in the show notes for the podcast and in the blog as well. But Donna, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Great to be here. Thank you, Sarah. And good luck to everyone out there fundraising.
Thank you. And thank you to all of you guys for watching another episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast. Please, if you haven't already, hit that subscribe button on YouTube so that you can be notified whenever our weekly podcast comes out. We will catch you next time.